everyone, welcome to the 382nd episode of the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and your co-host,
Kevin Toefel.
And we have a lot to talk about, as usual. First, we're going to talk about Helium and some interesting takes on the internet. Then we're going to talk about use cases for Apple AirTags, both good and ill. Kevin has reviewed the Eve motion sensor with Thread. We'll talk about that. We've got an update on what you should know about Ring and Google video cameras and how that data could be shared with the police. We've got a startup that is helping scooters stay on sidewalks or get off sidewalks, depending on which is most appropriate for that area. And we've got some satellite news, plus an update on the GE Sync lights. And our guest this week is Jim Ethington, who is the CEO of Arable, a precision agriculture startup that has raised $40 million. And Jim is going to tell us all about the new use cases for precision agriculture that are go beyond ROI. So all of this and more awaits you, plus a message from our sponsor, Influx Data. But first, before we get into it, let's hear from another one of our sponsors. This week's sponsor is Intent. Are you developing an app for a connected device? When you partner with Intent, you don't just work with a build team. They're going to act as a think partner to guide your hardware project to success. Intent has more than 12 years of experience in delivering stunning IoT and connected device projects, including the Aura Ring, the Bose and Macintosh in-car entertainment systems. Plus, with an extensive background in mobile and web app development, firmware and hardware, they can help you design and build software solutions for the world of connected devices, from new ideas to products entering an established niche. So you can check out their success stories at withintent.com/portfolio. Okay, now let's talk about Helium. Woofman. Let's get some disclosures out of the way first. I have a Helium hotspot that I've been running for a really long time, like since, we'll say 2020. And I was running it because I like having, like being a part of an IoT network. I'm like, yeah, we totally need that. I have made a couple $1,000s from selling H&Ts, and I'm still running my Helium hotspot network. So know that I have sort of an interest, but it's really not much of an interest.
Right. And I have a similar interest, only a much less shorter time frame of using the hotspot. It's only been 4 months because it took 18 months to get. I have a total of 4 Helium tokens now worth about $36. Woohoo! And the hotspot costs me $4.50.
Wait, so how long have you had it?
4 months.
4 months you've generated basically a dollar a month?
No. About not, no, one token a month.
One token a month, which is like currently trading at like $8 or $9.
Yeah. Right. And the price of those tokens has gone down dramatically in the last 8 months or so. Like you would, I know you had sold some and I think it was like trading in the 40s.
Yeah, I don't think I sold any of that. The highest I think I sold it was like 22. But I was like, ooh, free money. Yeah.
Right. And then my revenue, if I were to sell right now again, would be like about $36 because it's like $9 a token. So... And this is a long-range, low-power LoRaWAN network where if you have the hotspot, you're contributing your home internet service to expand the network because the IoT devices and such with the right radios get on that network wirelessly, but they can't get to the internet on their own, so we provide the internet for them.
Yes, and I will say most of my, like, you can see a breakdown on, basically, if you were running a hotspot, you get paid a couple ways. One, from saying, hey, I'm here, I'm a hotspot, and then validating other hotspots
right.
And making sure they're there.
Proof of coverage.
Proof of coverage. And then you also get rewards for actually sending actual data. I will tell you that I think I've only sent one data packet my entire time. I've only noticed at least one.
I've sent 3 to the internet based on the wireless connectivity. So we're going to get to this point a little bit later in the topic here. It's important. Yeah,
it is important. That's why I'm foreshadowing.
Yeah.
Okay. So what happened this week is that is he a venture capitalist? What is he?
I believe he's an angel investor.
He's an angel investor.
Yes.
He basically plays, his name is Liron Shapira, and he plays a skeptical role on Web3. And you know what? Good for him. I'm not a huge Web3 fan. What I am a fan of with Helium is the fact that we needed a low-cost IoT network that you could buy access to for like not even pennies on the dollar, like tenths of pennies. So you could connect all sorts of stupid stuff to the internet, right? Because you didn't have to worry about paying a cellular carrier a lot of money. So to do this, though, Helium realized that you could only do this if you didn't actually have to set up your own towers and manage it. So what they did is they created the Helium Network. It's the Helium Network, and the company is now no longer Helium. It's called Nova Labs. And what happened is the CEO of Nova Labs was like, hey, the best way to do this is to get other people to build it for you, incentivize them with these tokens, and they'll maintain and operate your network for you, which means we can charge very little for access to it. And that's actually a really good thing.
Yeah.
What happened, I think, is the crypto bubble of last year really drove up the price of HNTs, and people got really excited. They were like, holy moly, I could make like $50 a day running one of these hotspots.
In fact, the hotspots were in short supply. There was very high demand, and people who bought originally at several hotspots ended up selling them. They bought them for like $400 or $500, and I've seen prices like $1,400, $1,500 for resales during that time period.
Yeah. So there was a bottleneck in production, so you couldn't get your hotspot right away.
Oh, I'm well aware.
Yeah. Kevin waited 18 months for his.
Yeah. Whee!
Okay, so there was a big article in a newsletter called The Generalist that covered Helium, and in there it mentioned that Helium's total revenue was only $6,500.
$6,561 in June, and that revenue is strictly from data credits. So basically the devices using the network to pay to use the network.
Those are companies like Lime, Cisco.
Right.
Yeah, so those companies are only generating $6,500 a month for
network service.
Yeah, network service. And he says this like this is a total sham. And part of me agrees with him, except here's the deal. One, the whole idea of this network is that it doesn't cost a lot of money. So you're not going to see cellular carrier like ARPUs here because...
What's an ARPU? I know, but...
Annual revenue per user. You're not going to see a lot of spending on data costs because you can connect like tens of devices for like less than a dollar a year. Okay, so that's one.
Right. Just to be clear, one Helium data credit, which is not a ton of data. It's not meant to be a ton of data. Just say some sensor data. To send it on the Helium network costs you 0.00001 cent.
Yeah. So now that's point one. Even if you've got a lot of devices, they're not going to generate a lot of money, which is why they set up the network this way on purpose, because they knew that if they spent millions of dollars building a network, they could never recoup those costs.
Right.
The second point is this. The Helium network today is that we're talking about with HNTs is designed for LoRaWAN devices or Helium's proprietary LongFi, but no one uses that. So there aren't as many LoRaWAN devices out there yet, and that's because there's been kind of a bottleneck in developing them. And the bottleneck's because there wasn't really a substantial enough network to build out LoRaWAN devices, and that it was hard. So with things like Helium and Senet, which is a more traditional LoRaWAN network, coming in and doing a roaming agreement with Helium, what you're going to see is hopefully more LoRaWAN devices because the connectivity is finally there. You don't want to buy a device if there's no network for it.
And that happens with cellular networks. When they first pop up in the, you know, six cities across the country, it's not like every device comes with whatever radio supports that network. It takes time. Even for the cellular companies, it takes several years. And this is kind of my point. I don't disagree with what he's saying because he makes some very valid points, you know, that Helium has raised $350 million in funding and they've convinced consumers to buy $250 million worth of hotspots and the company only made $6,500 on the final product. I get it. I totally understand that. But because of what you just pointed out, it's going to take time. And it was a chicken and egg thing. Without a network, no devices are going to use the radios for the network. It's taken 2 to 3 years to build this network. I'd say it's plenty big enough to support tons of devices now, all over at least the U.S. and other areas, because I know they have roaming agreements overseas and such. But when you look at the figure of $6,500, if you don't take into account, and he did not, the data credit, That works out to 65 million data packets in June. That's a lot.
That is a lot.
That's why the number of revenue is so low, is because it's so darn cheap. And he did not, he just glossed over that. And I responded on Twitter nicely because I think he's spot on with a lot of his assessment. It's just, it's an assessment at this point in time. And then there is no looking forward with the actual, you know, hard data of, well, how many devices are on the network? How many data credits are actually used to generate that money and so on and so forth? So
I'm going to add to this, though, because the Helium network was built very quickly, right? In the last year, it's more than doubled in size. It might have tripled. I don't have all, like, I can't remember the exact number it was a year ago. So a lot of that growth has come because everybody was like, holy cow, I need to get on this, like, money-making train, right? And they put in their hotspots. That's fine. The question going forward is, how many of those people will be incentivized at $8 per HNT and only making, you know, one HNT a month? So how many people will be incentivized at like $8 or $9 a month to run one of these? And that's a really interesting question. And we don't know the answer to that yet, but that's really basically what this conversation boils down to. And there was a lot of talk in here about Helium's 5G plans. I am less optimistic about their 5G plans, mostly because I don't see a lot of best effort 5G cases. So I see a lot of best effort IoT cases for like low data rate, like sensor data, right? If you want a hugely reliable network, you're still going to go with cellular. You might go with a managed IoT network like Senet or Comcast has Machine Q, which also uses LoRa. So you might do something like that as opposed to kind of this ad hoc best effort Helium network. And when you take that out to 5G, which is huge data rates, I don't know that many applications that require a lot of data without wanting some sort of guarantee of quality of service on it.
You're never going to have that quality of service on a decentralized network. You have no control over it. I agree with you.
And then the next part is building out the 5G network, the equipment is much more expensive, but the backhaul. So again, you know, the Helium network's running over my Wi-Fi, which is fine for LoRaWAN because it's very little data. Even if you wanted to like send millions of packets, it's fine. It's not going to impact my data on my home network. But when you talk about 5G, that's a lot more data. And I don't know how you're going to get that backhaul subsidized.
Well, I think it's a different network for a different use case and business model, quite honestly. So I agree with you. I don't see the big play here being 5G, no matter how much Helium may want it to be. To me, it's massive amounts of devices sending small amounts of data over long range at low power. And like I've seen hotspots of at least 15 kilometers away with this. So there's certainly good range. The core business model is for IoT devices, I believe. So all the other hype is just hoo-ha.
Feels kind of like hype. So yeah, then the next question is, so is Helium really worth $1.2 billion as strictly an IoT network when you're looking at selling such low data rates? Maybe if we ever get to the trillion sensors sending these things, but you know, that's an open question. So that's our Helium take.
And honestly, if people are interested in buying a Helium hotspot, you can still buy them. I mean, you know, your money is your money. I don't think I would buy it if you were into solely making money, is what I would say. Because I'm not. I mean, it's going to take at least 3 years to recoup my investment at the current levels of HNT. And I'm not going to be a crypto guy and say, oh, it's going to go up or it's going to go down. I don't know. But I like the fact that I have added some benefit to future users of this network. Maybe it'll make me money, maybe it won't. I don't care at this point. So
yeah, and it could make you more money as, you know, more devices get online. We're at the very beginning of LoRaWAN devices getting online.
Exactly.
So that's that. Apple AirTags. We've talked about them before. They were in the news recently for two reasons. One of these stories is a little old, but it's worth talking about. It's about a Canadian car theft ring that actually goes through cities and they have a list of cars that they want to steal, right? And they mark those cars with AirTags when they encounter them. So they'll see a car and they'll be like, oh, I want this. Pop an AirTag somewhere on it so they can find it later. And
if then you see something, steal something.
Yeah. And then they pick an evening and they go out and they steal those cars. And then they round them up, bring them in, and ship them off to someplace else. Cool. Very innovative. Applause to the thefts.
Give them credit. They're also scanning for the fob codes later to get, so they're not just your average, I'm going to stick a marker on a car and then I'm going to come back and steal it later. They're putting some effort into it. So kudos to them.
This is organized crime. The article that we'll link to talks about that. And then they also talk about how an owner who had AirTags in their car after their first car was stolen, they have a Range Rover, which apparently is a car that people want to steal. So they put some AirTags in their car. And so when it was stolen, they were able to track it to a port in a nearby Canadian city and thus get the police involved. And the police were like, "Oh, okay, we'll check it out." And they went and they discovered this ring and all was
29 discovered. Other vehicles in a container stolen.
Yeah. Is this a good story? Is this a bad story? It kind of shows the double-sided nature of technology, right?
True. I do use AirTags. I bought them when they first came out, about a 4-pack. And we use them for our mailbox key because that always seems to be missing, which now it never is. But I also do tuck one under the locked seat of my motorcycle. And yes, I know, I guess you could try and unlock it now. And if you find my particular motorcycle and remove the AirTag, but I don't think anybody's going to do that. So I don't mind saying it. It's just an added low-cost bit of security because I'm sure it's going to show up on the Find My network if somebody were to try and steal it. It's cheap insurance. I should also mention, I think Apple said the batteries last for about a year. I just got the first alert about 2 weeks ago after a year and a half.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, one of the batteries is gone. It's just a cheap coin cell battery. So
the AirTags are about $30 a pop, right?
You get a 4-pack for $99, which is what I did. So you're down to $25. And occasionally there's a sale. But yeah, so $25 or $30 each, depending on if you buy in bulk or not.
Okay. Where else do you put them? Do you put them in your luggage, Kevin?
You know, it's funny you say that because I haven't traveled in a while, but I have one spare AirTag that I would put in my luggage if I were traveling on a flight.
So I travel and my husband, he's stuck them in all of our luggage, which drives me absolutely bonkers for a couple reasons. Number one reason is when you're traveling, everybody else has these in their luggage. And so you get a million notifications that somebody else's AirTag is following you. Like constantly in the hotel, on the airplane, it gets old. What's weird to me is that whenever I'm traveling, someone is always like freaked out about my AirTag following them. And the little beeping thing goes off constantly.
In your tag.
In my tag. Happens in the middle of the night in my hotel room. And I'm like, buddy, I am not stalking anyone. I'm just next door to you in a hotel room.
This is all part of Apple's beefed up security on these so that you are not, so somebody doesn't tuck an AirTag in your backpack, purse, pocket, whatever, and track you. So maybe it's a little overzealous, but I think I'd rather have that than not know somebody could be tracking me.
Yes, I would ask that people think for a second before freaking out when they're traveling.
Travelers, think.
I get it, but I'm like, oh, come on. You know why there's so many AirTags following you right now? Because we all have suitcases with AirTags in it. Okay.
Yeah.
That leads us to a Bloomberg story that was all about, like, should you put an AirTag in your luggage? And I've always been of the opinion, because my husband has stuck tiles before there were AirTags, I'm like, does it make you feel good to know, like, he's always checking when we're on the flight, like, about to take off. He's like, okay, the luggage is with us. I'm like, what if it weren't? What would we do?
What are you going to do?
So he maintains that it's awesome. And Brad Stone, who wrote this article, apparently feels much like I do, but he got so many use cases from people who talked about, like, right now there's luggage is in chaos for summer travel around the world. And a lot of people are losing their suitcases and they're able to see where their suitcases are. That makes them happy. They're able to argue with people at the airport and be like, my suitcase is like literally right here. Please let me go get it.
I know how your husband uses these. I would not put these in my luggage just to make sure they made the flight and they're in baggage claim C1 or whatever. My airline app does that for me, right? Mm-hmm. I would do it in case I went to go get my luggage or I didn't even make it to the baggage claim and my luggage is starting to leave the baggage claim. That means somebody picked up the wrong bag. That's the biggest thing for me. And if I can get to them before they leave the airport, there's a very good chance I'm going to be able to get my luggage back, and or maybe even get, if they got away on a taxi or something, maybe track them down to say, are you sure you have the right luggage, and get my luggage back. That's really what I would be using it for.
Yeah, maybe you'd be the person like ping, ping, pinging in the hotel. To be fair, right. It's always my luggage. All right. So, yay. Okay, Kevin, you tested out the Eve Motion device, and this is notable because it has Thread. What'd you think?
Yes, it's $40, just to be upfront. It's basically the same as the old Eve Motion sensor, just the addition of Thread. And that preps it for Matter, which means in the future, even though it's HomeKit compatible now, like all other Eve products, all of their Thread/Matter products will or should work with Amazon's ecosystem, Google, Samsung's, etc. So we're not there yet. Obviously, I can't test that yet. I will say the setup process, well, it's HomeKit. It's super simple. Took 30 seconds. The device shows up in my Eve Thread network, showed up right away. It's not a border router. It's not a plugged-in device with a direct connection to my Wi-Fi, for example, because it only has Bluetooth and Thread radios inside. But it's lickety-split if you're looking for a fast motion sensor. And I say that even if you're not a HomeKit person, because eventually, like I said, you should be able to use it with other products. So best use case for me, just for testing, every once in a while, we get thirsty in the middle of the night, go downstairs to a dark first floor, I stub my toe, walk into a wall, and we all have a good laugh. Well, I put the motion sensor down there and set up an automation that if it detects motion from certain hours, say 10:30 p.m. to 5:30 a.m. when our lights are off, just turn on my Lutron under-the-counter LED lights using that Lutron switch. It works like a charm. It's super fast. I was smart. I had my family test it because they're not into the smart home. And they're like, oh, that works lickety-split. Yes, we should get one of these. So it does motion. It also does light levels, brightness measured in lux. So you can use that as a trigger event. Again, $40 might sound expensive for a sensor that does just the two things, motion and light, but it's really good, really, really good. And oh, it's IPX3 water resistant, so you can use it outdoors.
IPX3?
Yeah, not the highest rating, I would agree.
Okay, sorry, I was like, that's not like anywhere near IP67.
No, fully waterproof would be like 68. It's water resistance. The first number is water resistance. The other number is dust. So,
yes.
Yeah, if you live in a dusty area, this is not for you outside anyway.
All right, let's talk about Ring. We, 2 weeks ago, I believe it was, mentioned that Senator Ed Markey, who had sent Amazon a letter requesting information about Ring sending data to police, got answers back. And apparently 11 times in the prior year, Ring had given information to law enforcement officials without notifying the owner. And Ring says that they did that through emergency requests. And those are a little bit different than warrants. An emergency request is like when someone is being kidnapped, when there's a bomb going off, when you don't have time to get a warrant, basically. Every tech company has to respond to these. Actually, very interesting. Probably a couple months ago, Facebook got in trouble because criminals were actually spoofing police departments, sending emergency requests to get access to people's Facebook accounts. And then they were getting access to like private photos and stuff that then they were like doing nefarious things with. So these can be abused, but that's what an emergency request is. So CNET did a great overview of everything they talked to Ring about with regards to this. So I'm going to link to this. You should totally read the whole article. But the big key issue is it's unclear if after in those use cases, those 11 use cases, Ring notified the people whose camera data was shared to law enforcement. Ring just said they don't have anything to share on that when asked, which doesn't feel great.
No, it doesn't feel great. But here, this is what really got me, and you have to scroll all the way down to the bottom here. Google Nest is also in this story because Google may choose to share information even without a warrant based on certain situations, certain emergencies. So, and we've talked about this with Ring specifically, and we've routinely said, you know, this could apply to just about any of these cameras. But this is the first time I've seen a Google comment and their standard operating procedure and all that. So this applies to you if you've got Google Nest cameras as well. And I only mention it because, here it comes, Stacey, get ready.
I hear you. Go for it.
This is why I use Apple's HomeKit Secure Video, which is fully encrypted, and Apple, not even Apple, can give the encryption or encrypted video. Well, they can give the video to police. But they can't see it. And that gets to the whole balance between security and privacy, because there might be times when I want them to see it, so I would have to actually share it with police.
Yes, and Ring did enable that as an option, so you can use end-to-end encryption. It did that last year.
As an option, not default.
As an option, and it does mess up some features, because once it's encrypted, you can't move that around easily to other devices. Apple is a little bit more seamless on that, so it sounds like maybe the concern here is maybe Ring's really trying to subtly influence people not to turn on end-to-end encryption.
That's my feeling, but I should point out, because they responded to the CNET story, Arlo, their current policy is not to produce videos to law enforcement, no matter what, unless they're compelled to via valid warrant or court order. So at least there's another company that's like, we're just going to respect, you know, what the legal system says we have to do, which is in a consumer's best interest, in my opinion.
Agree. Okay, moving along. This company got funding. We just thought it was worth noting because it's kind of fun. This is a company called Drover.ai. It raised $5.4 million, and it's a standalone IoT device that goes on scooters, like little mobile scooters, and it can assess like how that scooter driver is driving the scooter. It also can enforce some GPS limits. And I think this is neat because they already have deals with some scooter makers, but it's just this attachable module that like analyzes the data and talks to the scooter to say like, hey, don't drive on this sidewalk. It's not allowed in this area. It's a nice way to make a scooter updatable and add this information that could be geographically different to an entire fleet of scooters.
Right. What I really like about it, they're providing the data for policy enforcement, and policies vary based on where, what city you're in. You know, some places you can't ride these on the sidewalks. So, you know, they could partner with scooter companies that offer scooters in Philadelphia, for example, and say, well, the law is no scooters on sidewalks. You have the data here through our module. You can enforce that policy. Whereas other cities don't have that policy, don't care. That's fine. They don't need to. I like what this could enable.
Yes. All right. Satellite news. Two stories for us to care about. Eutelsat or Eutelsat. We don't know. and OneWeb have signed a provisional takeover deal that's going to value OneWeb at $3.4 billion and basically creates an IoT and a broadband satellite company for Europe. Today, they mostly offer broadband connectivity, but they're also, as part of this deal, going to create a low-power wide-area IoT network that uses LoRaWAN and maybe NB-IoT. So this is going to be an all-stock deal, and it'll have that $3.4 billion price tag, and it could close in the first half of 2023. We're seeing a lot of consolidation in the satellite space as people realize that there are way too many, not everybody needs to operate their own constellation, and as they recognize that getting those birds up in the air is going to require more funding in a time when funding isn't exactly available.
That's why I'm going to start HeliumSat, the decentralized satellite network for IoT. I'm going to have everybody launch their own satellites.
Everybody launch a satellite. Okay, next up, Astrocast, which is a tiny nanosatellite IoT operator. They bought a company called Hyber, actually, that provides satellite connectivity to oil and gas rigs around the world. So Astrocast is working with Soracom. And they're going to basically, Soracom's going to offer the Astrocast satellite IoT as part of its connectivity offerings. This means if you're a Soracom customer, you now have access to this IoT option. Yay. That's going to give Astrocast access to Soracom's more than 20,000 customers that might have IoT devices in places that cellular doesn't reach. Yay. All right. That's enough satellite news. Let's talk about light bulbs. I don't know. Kevin?
Yeah, so I have a couple of the GE, well, what used to be GE Lighting, the Sync, C-Y-N-C bulbs, and they're good bulbs, but the app is, I'm just going to say, it's not up to snuff. I'm trying to be polite here. However, there is a new update to the Sync app for all you sync people, new schemes and scheduling features. They basically cleaned up and made it far more intuitive and simpler to create routines and scenes. This is how they really always should have been. You can now, like you used to have to turn off devices by adding a second schedule to something. Like you need a turn on schedule and a turn off schedule. Now you can do it all in one schedule, which kind of makes sense, people. You've got sunrise and sunset options now, preview scenes and your scene creator. Basically, you want to go update your sync app. It's going to be so much better.
Now, it's the portion of the show where we hear from you on the Internet of Things podcast hotline. This section of the show is sponsored by Works With, an event from Silicon Labs. Works With has emerged as the go-to developer conference for building the skills needed to create impactful connected devices. This September, Silicon Labs is going to bring together global technology brands, partners, and industry experts to describe some of their exciting advances in the IoT industry. There's going to be keynotes, there's going to be panel discussions, and technical sessions. You can learn more at workswith.silabs.com. I will be there. Woo! Okay, so about the IoT Podcast Hotline, if you call us at 512-623-7424, we may answer your question, but you will be added to our entry pile for a drawing at the end of the month, and if you win, you will win a Hubitat, so that's pretty cool. This is a DIY smart home hub that, why wouldn't you want it? Okay, so that's what you're going to win for the month of July, and this week's question doesn't come to us in the form of a voicemail, but from several insistent Twitter mentions and DMs from people who want to know what we think about the Insteon fees. So here is that moment. Back in April, Insteon abruptly shut down. Then in May, Insteon abruptly came back up. And then soon after that, we saw a blog post on the Insteon website that said, hey, if you want cloud access to your Insteon hub, you will have to purchase service for $39.95 a year. If you buy 2 years, you can get it for $69.95. So $40 for a year service, that's going to give you mobile app access to the Insteon hub, email and push notifications, voice assistant integrations. Today, Madam A is supported and Google Assistant is coming back. So basically all the cloud stuff that broke, now you can have access to that. And people wanted to know what we thought about this. And I think this is actually probably a positive sign.
I would agree. I mean, I'm not big into subscriptions unless they provide, you know, a lot of value. And I get why people are upset because some of the people who reach out are upset. When you're used to not paying for something and then you lose features and then they get them back, you got to pay. It's human nature. I get it. But take a step back for a second and look at what you're getting and look at the fact that these services often require investments on a regular basis from companies to provide these services, the cloud services. So I get it. You know, I'm not happy about it either. I wouldn't be if I was an Insteon user, but I would pay for it because I'm getting a lot. And I realize these things aren't free. You know, I do some cloud services on the side and I got to pay a few bucks a month just to keep my own little testing things going. I get it. So I'd say take a step back and really think about it. And if you're still unhappy, you've got other options, you know?
Yes, you could do a DIY platform that doesn't require, we talked about Hubitat or SmartThings or a Home Assistant. Those come with the pain of doing a DIY setup. So yes, I would say that I understand where this is coming from. We're going to have Ken Fairbanks, the gentleman who is part of the team that bought Insteon. He'll be on the show in the next few weeks. And we're going to talk about why they're doing this particular subscription plan and what else they want to offer with it. And yeah, so our thoughts on that are, you know, nobody likes a subscription, but if you're getting something for value, there is a cost associated with that. And recognize that the company now is owned by new people. They're trying to extricate themselves from the previous management, which can be a challenge, and make a viable business, which apparently the previous management couldn't do. So, you know, there's that. You might have nothing if you don't do this. Speaking of hubs, by the way, as someone who paid for Wink for a while, Wink is back online. It only took almost a month. So just, you know, if you're still on that Wink hub or you still just have one sitting around, blinking at you, it'll blink blue again and it'll be online. Okay, that concludes the Internet of Things podcast hotline. Remember, if you would like to give us a call, it's at 512-623-7424. You'll be entered to win a Hubitat. And please call us with your questions. We would love to answer them. I would say please don't call us about getting 2.4 gigahertz devices onto a mesh network, because we've answered it a lot. But if that's your problem space, we can help you. We have written about it, so Google is your friend in that case. That concludes this segment of the show. Please stay tuned for our guest, Jim Ethington, who is the CEO of Arable. We're going to be talking about precision agriculture, what to do with all this data, and what it means for the future of food up next. But first, a message from our sponsor. This week's sponsor is Influx Data. Hey everyone, we are taking a quick break from the Internet of Things podcast for a message from our sponsor. And this week's sponsor is Influx Data, the makers of InfluxDB. And I have Brian Gilmore here with me. First up, why don't you tell me, what is InfluxDB?
Well, I think before we talk about InfluxDB itself, we should back up and talk about what time series data is. Time series data, it's all time stamped. So simply any type of data that's time stamped in some way, whether it's every hour, every minute, or every second. And that includes both regular time stamped data, stuff that happens on a regular interval, and irregular stuff, which we call events. All IoT data today is time stamped.
And why does a purposely built time series platform matter for IoT folks?
Everybody's looking for scale and precision, and that is oftentimes very difficult to get with off-labeled or other applications, databases that aren't really designed for time series data. Our entire roadmap is completely focused on the needs of time series developers. And what we try to do is we try to sort of manage that roadmap and deliver capabilities that are critical for developers and operators who are working with, you know, multi-million dollar assets and operations.
And I saw you recently launched a new feature for edge data replication. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. We're excited about it. Edge data replication is a new capability that we've built into version 2.2 of our open source distribution. It allows developers who have InfluxDB OSS as well as InfluxDB Cloud to unify them into a single vertically oriented and integrated time series platform. Add to this our ongoing efforts to unify APIs across all of those database offerings, whether it's in the cloud or in the data center or at the edge. And we now have a path for developers to build once and deploy anywhere, because it's all managed within our database write path and in our time series processing language called Flux. Edge data replication is durable and scalable in ways we couldn't even imagine 2 years ago.
Why is edge data replication such a big deal for developing IoT apps?
Going back to that sort of purpose-built thing, this is exactly what we mean. IoT, especially enterprise and industrial IoT, are generally highly distributed from both a compute and storage perspective. Data has a point of origin, meaning a place where it's born, typically close by the sensor. A force of gravity, meaning that there's a drive to get to that data from a sort of application and script perspective. And it also has a half-life, meaning that it is most valuable sort of right at the point of generation, and that value declines generally over time. So our edge data replication does exactly this. It brings the horsepower closer to the sensor, and it gives developers and solution builders the ability to leverage their own resources deployed at the edge. And that opens the door for more advanced use cases with better and faster return on investment. Now, InfluxDB should be looked at as a vertically integrated stack with edge and cloud together finally.
This sounds great. So where can people go to find out more about InfluxData and InfluxDB?
The best place to check it out is influxdata.com/Stacy-IoT.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacy Higginbotham, and today's guest is Jim Ethington, who is the CEO of Arable. Hello, Jim. How are you today?
Hi, Stacy. I am doing wonderful today. Thank you for having me on.
I am really happy to have you because I have followed Arable since 2016. And we've had the founder and former CEO, Adam Wolf, on. And I've been excited about precision agriculture forever. Why don't we level set for everybody? Arable makes a sensor array that is connected, and farmers stick it in their field and gather data from it. Is that a fair start?
Yes, that is the basics of what we do. We produce an IoT device that goes out in farm fields, collects a whole suite of really comprehensive data about the weather, about the crop itself, about the soil, and then it transmits that to the cloud and delivers on top of that base data actionable insights to the farmer through our mobile and web application.
Right. So it's not like, hey, your field's dry. It's like, hey, you should water.
Yes, I think that's a key part of what we've been able to build over the last couple of years is moving from, you know, providing a farmer with a bunch of data into really translating that through to sort of their language, what they care about. You know, how much water do I need to put down tomorrow, this next week? You know, is now a good time to go out and spray something to protect that crop or to fertilize and things like that.
And you're pulling this data in from the sensor array. Are you also pulling in data from other sources to deliver these insights, like, I don't know, weather sources?
Yes. So that's one key element of what we bring in outside of our own data, which would be weather forecasts, for example, where we can provide this really easy way to get local information about what's happening in the field. And then we combine that with larger, or say, gridded or remote sense data sets like weather forecasts and blend the two together. To give you this full picture.
All right. And y'all just raised $40 million. And that is no mean feat because, my gosh, in the last month or so, the spigots have tightened. There's no money for anyone. So if you want to just talk to me about the fundraising effort and what y'all plan to do with this money.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I think about any time or when we're fundraising as an opportunity to add new folks, a new partner to the Arable team. And that's really what I'm most excited about here is the new groups that we were able to add, which is Galvanize Climate Solutions and Qualcomm Ventures. And so with Galvanize, they are totally focused on helping to advance new technologies, new innovations around the climate. And that is dead center aligned with our mission and what we care about here at Arable. And then with Qualcomm, they are one of the global leaders in IoT, in sensors, in edge computing, in how to translate that data through things like machine learning and visual analysis. And so they are just a huge leg up for us in a lot of the forward-looking R&D that we do. And yes, I think when you look at the total landscape, it's certainly it's tough out there. And we're fortunate and proud of what we're able to do here. I will say that you look at our particular space, which is food and agriculture, and people still need to eat. Farms are still growing. There's a lot of disruption and challenges going on, but the need has never been greater for products like ours, and the need to advance both productivity and sustainability in the food system is only growing and actually growing incredibly rapidly. So I think those are great tailwinds for us.
Yeah. So let's talk about this because precision agriculture is not a new concept. Big companies, small companies, crazy robotics companies, they're all working on things like weeding, reducing the use of pesticides, making sure you're watering your crops properly for the weather. All of this is happening a bunch of places. Arable's a little unique in that, one, it's a startup and that it provides hardware to farmers, which they're mechanically inclined, but I think it's probably a difficult sell to say, hey, I'm going to put some sensors in the fields. So how did Arable kind of come to that decision?
Yeah, and I think it goes back to a little bit of how I came to Arable and what Arable was doing all along, which is this really important realization that if we are going to use data to drive better outcomes on the farm, we have to first start by understanding what are the characteristics or parameters of that data that are going to be necessary? And in my previous job, I worked for a company called the Climate Corporation, and we spent years and years and lots of human capital and financial capital on trying to use data in somewhat similar ways. And it really became apparent to me that a lot of these problems we were trying to solve, whether it was around more efficient irrigation or better use of fertilizers, the data that was available was never going to get us there. It had too much noise, it was too sparse temporally. It was just not reliable. It was not set up to deliver trust for the customer. And so it was sort of a hard-won set of realizations about what that data really needed to be like. And on the flip side, the existing examples of how you could get the right data were too cumbersome, too expensive, not really something a farmer would use at scale. And so this idea of, hey, we need to make it really simple, really easy, sort of consumer level ease of use to get this data. But that data, it needs to be accurate. It needs to be complete, as in covering not just one slice of the system, like an image from a satellite, but that can tell you about the plant, but also the weather, the soil, sort of this whole system or loop so you can model it. And that was something that was, you know, on my mind and also on Arable's mind sort of simultaneously. And that's when I joined up 4 years ago. So that kind of gets you to, well, why would I need these sensors in my field? And it's to get to a system that can actually be used to make and change decisions. And we talk about that as sort of decision grade data quality. And that, at least today, is only really possible by having some measurements that come directly from the field. And for the farmer, you know, it is, if what they get out of it is an accurate and reliable way to improve decisions and their ROI, you know, it's an easy trade to say, hey, I can put some equipment in the field if it's getting me a better outcome around my profitability at the end of the year.
And let's talk about this idea that we can take all of this data, create these actionable insights, and really move the needle, which I totally think is possible. But I feel like we might not be realistic about what is actually possible versus like what we envision. And I think probably at Climate Core, you probably experienced this, which is this idea that we can accurately model out the weather in really tiny places, but weather is so hideously complicated. Yep. So you obviously can't get to 100%. You might not even be able to get to 95%. I don't know. And agriculture is similar, especially given climate change and how things are not the same from year to year. So level set for people, because people hear precision ag and they're like, oh my gosh, it's magic. It will take all the available data and it will tell me I should plant this here at this time of day and give it this much water. You know, give us a reality check.
I am happy to. And I think that is a mistake that precision agriculture and sort of the more specific variant digital agriculture has made is over-promising and under-delivering. And yeah, there's a lot of magic that is pitched. But at the end of the day, you know, you're not getting that past a farmer. You know, the proof will be in the pudding as it goes out in the field, and it all becomes clear eventually. And so, you know, I think probably a more realistic and prudent approach is, you know, to start with the lower hanging fruit or the more directly sort of solvable challenges, of which many, many exist in agriculture, and to be able to deliver, you know, real value and real reliability around those. And so I'll give you a couple examples. You know, in the bucket that you described, which is, hey, we're going to provide a meaningful and reliable 3-month forecast of what the weather is going to be and then tell you what to do based off of that. Or, you know, we're going to take a very limited amount of data and that has, you know, a lot of reliability challenges, and we're going to tell you exactly what to do on your farm. You know, those are not really realistic in terms of, you know, working frequently enough. And you can, you know, think about putting yourself in that farmer's shoes. If I provided you a system on which each year you basically bet your livelihood and I told you it was right 75% of the time, well, you wouldn't use that. You're right more than that already. And so you really have to hit a high bar. There are many other areas where I think we can create a lot of value. You go back to Climate Corp. One of the areas we had a ton of success was, you know, connecting farm equipment and getting that data off the tractor into the cloud, helping people see what was really happening around what they planted and what they harvested. And that proved to be quite valuable and connected quite a bit of the farm equipment through those mechanisms in the North America and South America. Now you kind of fast forward to Arable. You know, we're focused on things like water and irrigation, where you look, you know, globally, there is inefficiencies in the way that irrigation is applied, based largely on the fact that farmers don't have all the tools they would like to really know how much water that plant needs. And it's only rational and reasonable to say, hey, we're just going to play it a little bit safe here. And rather than, you know, cutting irrigation down on this date, we're going to cut it down a couple weeks later. And it's incredibly complex to try and manage a set of decisions like that. And so the better we can make tools for farmers, the bigger leg up they're going to have in being able to squeeze out more and more efficiency. I think when you have a step change in the amount of data that you can and insights that you can look at, and how easy it is to get access to that, there are significant improvements that can be made. And we see a lot of our customers playing that back to us, which is, hey, this just supercharged the decisions I was already making. You know, I got the information I needed much faster, much simpler. It helps me to keep a closer eye on these things, not get caught off guard, see all 50 of my fields all at once. And so those things make a difference.
Let's talk about the mission of precision agriculture over time. Ever since the Green Revolution, we were like, hey, we need to produce enough food to feed people. And now we're like, oh, hey, we need to produce enough food, but we need to do it in ways that are maybe more sustainable in terms of not putting as many pesticides, maybe not using as much water. And we also are dealing with the effects of climate change, which is changing growing regions really rapidly. And I'm curious if there are new things, new vectors coming up that matter more now in terms of driving adoption of precision agriculture, or new use cases that are becoming more apparent?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we hear examples of all of those that you mentioned from our customers, whether it's large food companies who are in the process of moving their entire production regions based on either already present or sort of expected to in the near future changes to the climate. You know, other things like needing to understand the real carbon footprint or overall sustainability footprint of, you know, a food company's supply chain or of a larger farm. Those are all things that our farmer customers are working on, you know, now and are super interested in. And so I think that does open up some new paths for the adoption of technologies in sort of the precision ag family. So for example, you wind it back 5-10 years, you know, the main value proposition was, hey, we're going to provide you this, you know, data insights. We're going to help make you 10% more efficient, and you'll pay some percentage of the savings that you got as it's the cost. Now there are a number of other tools or levers for value, which is, you know, really understanding and having other reasons to benefit from more sustainable practices, whether that's the fact that I can now sell my crop for a higher price, whether as a food company you have committed to delivering on these sustainability promises, or in the future, the prospect of looking at reductions in greenhouse gas emissions or increases in carbon sequestered into the soil as other potential ways that these technologies can create profit for farmers. So some of those are pretty early still. Some of them are certainly developing. And so I think all of it, though, bodes well for the uses of technology on the farm and how they can benefit a farmer.
Yeah, I'm definitely excited about the shift from like straight up ROI on a capital cash kind of basis and more of an ROI on a environmental or sustainability basis, just because once we start measuring that, we're like, holy cow, we really should focus on this a little. As we move towards precision agriculture and we get more data and we can get better insights about the quality of the crops that we're delivering, how does that change the commodities market, the market for, I guess, food and other crops? Is there a shift that will happen because we can anticipate the quality of things earlier?
Yes, I think so. I think a couple of the ways that we are seeing that develop right now are, if you look at sort of our entire food system and what are some of the bigger shifts that are happening, you know, one is being driven by the consumer. And that is a desire to know more about the food that they eat, to know more about its quality, where it came from. And that's, you know, still early, perhaps, but I think going to only increase from here on out. And so having a better understanding of what was used to grow that crop, how did it grow, things like that, creates a big opportunity there for farmers to get credit for the things that they're doing and to incentivize them. I think it's very historically been somewhat unfair, the positioning that we have towards farmers, which is, hey, why don't you just go out and do all of these things, but not necessarily, that may be risky for your business or costly to you, but without providing them either the tools to do it effectively, be it technology or boots on the ground, or the incentives. And so the market shifting actually creates a really interesting opportunity from the consumer side to align these incentives better. And then, you know, as you look at just supply chain, food supply chains globally, this was really exposed at the beginning of COVID, where there was all of these dislocations in demand. What it showed was, you know, we have a pretty antiquated food supply chain, and, you know, we don't really understand how much is coming from where. We don't really have an ability to shift it all that readily. And that'll be complex, but I think we see a lot of interest and a lot of movement already of companies saying, hey, we really need to understand how much is being produced, where and when and at what quality, so that we can be more agile in terms of how we adjust to that. And it's not just food companies or farms, it's also countries and NGOs who are looking to better understand food production and its dynamics. And we work with the World Food Program in Mozambique, providing a network of information to help bring about climate resilience for those farmers, so that the farmers can actually take steps and decisions throughout their growing season, but also so that we can have a better understanding of what's happening in that region and help to protect against food shortages and the other impacts that we're already seeing today from climate change.
Yikes. All right. So you can do your job better. This is the fun hardware question. What do you need in terms of maybe it's connectivity, maybe it's new sensors? What would you like in future hardware iterations? What should the world be developing for making precision ag better?
Absolutely. This is like the Christmas list part. I'll give you two big categories. One is connectivity. So, we connect around the world in 40 countries. And we are always looking for better, faster, cheaper ways to do that. So whether that's newly emerging satellite-based communications, and there are a number of pretty interesting and exciting low Earth orbit communication satellites going up, and other ways to sort of communicate from device to device. So everything that can help us get that data off the device and into the cloud, or from other nearby devices to a main device and then up into the cloud. Those are super interesting, and we follow very closely some of all of the technological developments that are happening in that space. And the other one is sensors. And so, we have an array of spectral and thermal visual sensors that we use that look down at the plant, but we're super keen on what's coming next there. And there's a lot of exciting developments around how cheap some of the really interesting sensors around full resolution thermal or spectral, think about like almost taking a picture with your camera on your phone, but being able to see it in these different dimensions. Those are super interesting, and I think not too far on the horizon. So a lot of those families of development that touch other parts of IoT, but certainly have massive applicability to agriculture, are exciting for us.
Yeah, so I'm envisioning something like the FLIR. So that was temperature sensing, but I know that I've talked to people about terahertz sensors. And so I'm trying to visualize, basically, you just be looking at different categories of light or health or something associated with a plant.
I mean, plants are fascinating. Two of the things that they do that kind of help connect the dots. One, as a plant is starved of water, closes its pores and stops transpiring or sweating. And just like a person, when it does that, it heats up. And so you can see that with these thermal sensors. And in terms of things like fertilizer, as different crops are short of nutrients in the soil, there are visible and non-visible light spectra changes that happen to the leaf. And so you can pick those up with the right types of sensors. And that's been really challenged by the fact that we've usually been trying to use pretty coarse and noisy sensors to do that on the spectral side. But if you get, start to see what is here or coming shortly, it's a whole new world in terms of the depth and breadth of spectral data that you can get. And that opens up all new possibilities around that. So those are two really exciting ones that I think will see a massive increase in their applicability and what you can do based on new sensor technology that's coming online.
Nice. Yeah, I always feel like everybody throws a camera at things. And I'm like, the way people see is not the way everything should see. So I appreciate that in this situation, because when I see a plant, it's not nearly as cool as like when bees or hummingbirds see a plant. So I'm like,
yeah, I think that's it's a fascinating point, which is that, there are all of these light spectra that can tell us different things that we don't see. And then there are a lot of things that you can do visually. And that's sort of another category of, using the really well-developed field of computer vision and sort of object identification to look more closely at what exactly that plant is doing off of things that look more like visual imagery. And so that is another exciting one that several companies out there are working on and is of high interest to us as well.
Nice. All right. Well, Jim, thanks so much for coming on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, Stacey, this was a lot of fun. Thank you for having me on.
And that concludes this week's episode of the Internet of Things podcast. Please join us next Thursday, and don't forget to subscribe. And if you can't get enough IoT news, I would love for you to sign up at www.stacyonIoT.com for our weekly IoT newsletter, where we explain all kinds of things that we don't even get to on the show. Once again, thank you for listening, and please subscribe.